I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Essie Weingarten, founder of the nail polish company Essie. Essie is available in roughly 25,000 salons in more than 100 countries. Essie launched in 1981 with $10,000, and the company was bought by L'Oreal in 2010. Essie is from Hollis Hill, Queens. Welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here, Jessica.
Before we get started, I'm noticing that you are wearing some red nail polish. Can I see your hands for a second? What do you call that color?
She's pampered.
When did that color come out?
Probably about 10 years ago, but it's so apropos now since I'm not working and I'm enjoying life and I feel very pampered.
When did you get them done?
Yesterday, as a matter of fact.
Mm. How did you come up with the name She's Pampered?
It was from a collection where it was all about opulence, and this was one of six colors, and it always is about the theme. So She's Pampered just looked right to me. It was like a rosy red, and it looked like any woman could wear it when she's feeling really special.
People who know the brand Essie, who use the nail polish, they know you for your names, as well as other attributes. Names range from wicked to fancy pants, tomboy no more, rock star skinny. And I feel like these names are just on the right side of naughty. Can you talk to us about your thinking surrounding the names?
Well, I always wanted to have a personality. So if the names had a personality, women would remember them. If it's numbers, it's so impersonal. And it's like, what number is it? If they don't remember the whole name, they remember something about the name. And there's a very funny story. A woman met me and she said to me, "Oh my God, you're Essie?" I was in a salon and this woman asked for dancing shoes. And I said, "That's not one of my colors." And she said, no, I know it's one of your colors." I said, "I don't have anything called dancing shoes." To make a long story short, she was talking about ballet slippers. And I said, "Oh, got it. Okay, ballet slippers," when we went through the whole thing, which, you know, everyone talks about ballet slippers when they're talking about a delicious pink color. And to me, it was my days of Miss Lee at ballet school. And everyone else wore black leotards, and I wore pink leotards. So it was always that childhood memory of me being feminine and special. And when the Queen of England wanted the Essie ballet slippers, I received a letter with the royal crest. And it was HRH, and it was the hairdresser of the Queen of England. And basically, he asked if I would sell them the polish, and I said, "Of course." He wanted to know if I could ship it immediately, and I said, "I'll hand deliver it." I mean, I thought I arrived at the moon.
So Queen Elizabeth wears ballet slippers. Wouldn't it be funny if she wore like bikini sotini?
I would love it. I think it would be so chic on her toes.
Speaking of Queen Elizabeth, there was another woman in the early days who really kind of helped you become. And I'm thinking of Joan Rivers.
Oh,
were you
Jelly
thinking of
Apple.
Joan Rivers?
Yes. Joan was very special. She was on Johnny Carson. She was basically, I think she was sidekick that night, and Johnny asked her what she was wearing. And she said, on the Tonight Show, "I'm wearing Jelly Apple by Essie." And I did get to thank her before she died in person. And I mean, that was a very special day in my life.
Where were you? Were you watching the show coincidentally?
Yes, I was. I mean, I was a Johnny Carson fanatic, so I didn't miss a show. If I was home, I saw it.
And this was in 1983?
It was probably 81 or 82.
So you didn't know this was coming to you. Can you describe that moment? Were you by yourself sitting on your couch? Or
I was in bed listening to Joan Rivers and Johnny, and all of a sudden it was like, did I hear right? And you pinch yourself. They're talking about my baby.
Did you get phone calls that night? Do you remember?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, lots of calls. And by the next morning, it was like everyone was talking about it.
And by the way, this is before social media, and this is before you're able to watch the show again and again on YouTube. You were lucky to have seen it. Otherwise, you would have just heard about it.
Absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. How the world has changed.
Right. So I want to go back to 1981 when you decided to launch Essie with $10,000. How did you muster the $10,000? Where did that come from?
I was working. I worked at Henri Bendel for a couple of years. I was going to FIT in the evening. And then after Bendel's, I went to work for a ladies' hosiery company that was owned by two brothers, and they did private label pantyhose.
Do you remember, like, the moment when you went in and you told your boss, you know what, I'm doing this company, I'm off on my own?
Yeah, I do. I said I was leaving, and he was not happy, and basically said, we're not going to give you the 10-year pin. And I went, well, I'll have to live without it. And I moved on. When you are ready to go, you got to go.
I love that you didn't get your 10-year pin.
No.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Essie Weingarten, founder of Essie, a nail polish company with more than 300 colors. The company was bought in 2010 by L'Oreal. What other ideas did you have for starting a business other than nail polish, or did you have a maniacal focus on?
I was pretty focused that there was no one doing colors that were great. A formula that would be looking wet for a whole week, and if I found the chemist to do it. And all major chemical companies and cosmetic companies were looking at the big picture. They were looking at foundations, where the money is. Nails, the money wasn't in nails. Mm-hmm. I mean, in 1981, there were only two big companies doing nail polish. And I just thought that, you know, it made me feel special if women started getting their nails done, because in 1981, women who had their nails done were very wealthy. It wasn't a luxury that we have today where everyone can have their nails done, the affordable luxury. So I went looking for a chemist, and that was a whole year of really getting ready. When I found the right chemist, and he gave me a few formulas, and I tested them out, and I found the formula that I loved, then I had to give him colors, and I was saving ribbons and pin cushions. And from all my travels, I saved colors that really spoke to me. Incredible colors that were sharp and clean, and clean was very important. I didn't, at that particular point, there were no muddy colors in my life. And he had to match the colors. And I know you're going to laugh, but I started with 12 colors. Mm-hmm. I mean, you try to start a line today with 12 colors, people would just turn their back on you. Mm-hmm. But it was such a different world. And I was a pioneer. I changed the way women think of nail color. It became a fashion accessory that if your nails are not polished, you're not dressed.
Right. And as you're talking to me, I'm curling my nails into my shirt so you don't see that I'm not wearing nail polish.
Well, you're half-dressed.
So you found this chemist who really, you know, helped you get everything off the ground. What was his or her name, and where was...
He was in New Jersey, and his name was Stanley. He's no longer with us, unfortunately, but he was a very big part of my success. I mean, I've always had an amazing team around me. He just listened.
So you launched with these 12 colors, and what did the names range from?
Well, some of them are still in the line. Bordeaux, which is like a very good bottle of red wine. It's a deep, delicious burgundy color. And Blanc and Baby's Breath. Blanc is that true chalk white, and Baby's Breath was a softer white for a French tip of a French manicure, which was a very big part of our beginning.
Very popular in the early 80s.
Yes.
So you launched, and you decided to go to Las Vegas when you launched because the women in casinos, you know, they had hands that everyone saw. And also it was a meeting place of sorts for women from all the coasts who traveled there. Can you talk about what you did in Las Vegas?
Yeah. I mean, it was very important to me that I'd go to a place where I get the best bang for my buck. And I thought Las Vegas in 81, between showgirls, dealers, dancers that were always in the public eye, that always had to have beautiful hands and beautiful feet. If I could get them to try the Essie polish, wow. Once you try it, you're hooked. It's the best addiction around. And it did work. I just left samples at every beauty salon, and there were less than 100 in 1981. And every hotel spa. I left them a little plastic bag with 12 colors and 3 treatments. And I said, call me if you like it. Within 2 weeks, every single one of them called and placed an order. And I was like, yes, I have a business.
You were in your early 30s at the time. Do you remember even that trip to Las Vegas with all of this nail polish in your bag?
Absolutely. It was like yesterday. We went to Kennedy Airport because it was a nonstop flight, and you were allowed to take whatever you wanted on the plane. I mean, I must have had 10 cartons weighing 64 pounds each. There was not a problem. Yeah. If you had 10 suitcases, they took 10 suitcases.
So you got this approval from Las Vegas immediately, but you also walked the streets of New York City, which is your hometown. Can you tell us about what that looked like?
Absolutely. I was very organized. So if I started on 96th Street, I did 96th, 95th, 94th, 93rd, from York to 5th. Then I took 86th Street and went down from there. Then I did the West Side. I mean, years ago, there weren't nail salons in every corner. I know you can't believe it. There were beauty salons.
And beauty parlors.
Beauty parlors, exactly. Mm-hmm. Some of the salons listed in the Yellow Pages. I didn't have a cell phone. Can you imagine? And you'd go up, and they were like really not salons. And you would run down the stairs because
what
there wasn't even elevators in the building.
What were they, if not?
It was something like, lady, what are you doing here? And I said, I don't think I belong here. Let me leave.
They were a different type of salon.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Did you have problems with making enough to fit the demand in the early days?
Well, the truth of the matter is, when I first started, I didn't think I'd ever be able to sell all the bottles that I had to because it was a minimum of gallons that you had to buy. And I'll never forget, they said to me, the minimum order is 55 gallons. And I went, and how many bottles do I get from 1 gallon? 1 gallon is 200 bottles. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. How am I going to sell one color and,
10,000 bottles, roughly. Mm-hmm,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was like, not a problem, because if the color's right and the quality is right, it's a give me. Everyone wants it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Essie Weingarten, founder of the nail polish company Essie. We'll hear more from Essie coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Essie Weingarten, founder of the nail polish company Essie. Essie is available in roughly 25,000 salons in more than 100 countries. Essie launched in 1981 with $10,000, and the company was bought by L'Oreal in 2010. The names that you come up with really are autobiographical in a way. They come from some fragment of your life. Can you give examples?
I mean, we have such funny stories. We were doing a trade show in Mexico City, and we went to hail a cab, and we saw the traffic wasn't moving. So we said, never mind. Now, in Mexico City, the taxis are little Volkswagen bugs, and the taxi drivers wear white gloves, and they open the door with, like, this little handle thing. And I went, never mind, never mind. And he yells out, you sand of a beach. It was like he was practicing this curse and he knew I was American. And he, well, needless to say, I had to come up with a color called Sand of a Beach. But, you know, we were in Paris July 4th and I fell on my behind. It was pouring rain. We were going to Café Fouquet. So I came up with a color right after that very quickly called Café Fagot, because I never want to forget Café Fouquet. When we were looking for a home in the Hamptons, so I came out with a collection, and the colors were, like, very important because it was south of the highway or Montauk the End or Dune Road or Picket Fence. It was something to do with the beach. And everyone said to me, oh, but the Hamptons, who's going to know about the Hamptons? Only people in New York. Well, it turned out that everyone in Europe wanted the Hampton collection. Everyone in Asia wanted the Hampton collection. Everyone in the Middle East wanted the Hampton collection. So it was just, I have to have the Hampton collection because everyone wants a piece of the Hamptons.
Going back to the early days of getting interest from New York salons, do you have any recollections of one or two beauty parlors that really helped to escalate sales for you?
Or? Absolutely. There was a place called Nail Nook on 2nd Avenue. It's no longer there. And 75th Street. And then Ruzica de Felica. We had Josephine Allen, who was on top of Yellow Fingers, and now she's at Essie Flagship Salon on 65th between Madison and Park.
For the first few years, you had a different bottle. Now there's this iconic bottle that's square-shaped, and it has your name, Essie. Your real name was Esther, but you were never called that, down the side. How did you decide to make that shift?
Well, when I first started and I went to the glass company, I said I wanted my own mold. And he said to me, well, to have your own mold, you have to sell at least 2 million bottles a year. And I went, oh my God, how am I going to do that? Well, shortly thereafter, within the first 4 years, I was able to do it with no problem. 2 consecutive years, and the bottle manufacturer said to me, if you really want to do your own mold, we can do it. And I said, it's really important to me. I needed something that would be very comfortable in the manicurist's hand because she's holding the bottle all day. I always like very angular things. I like straight lines. I'm not about roundness. And I came up with this bottle, which is round on the inside but square on the outside, and all the edges are soft round. So it fits right into the nail tech's hand, and the weight is evenly distributed.
Now, the anatomy of a bottle is, as you described, the bottle itself, but there's also the brush, and there's a little metallic, is it a steel ball inside?
2 stainless steel mixing balls. If you have one, it doesn't do anything. You need the friction of the 2 balls hitting each other, and that's just to keep everything blended. So you just roll it in your hands. You don't shake it because the 2 mixing balls can break through the glass. So you roll it and you keep the polish nice and fresh.
And the brush, is there anything special about the hairs or anything?
Absolutely. Our brushes were custom made for us. All the brushes had 199 hairs, and we always kept the brushes very thin so you can get into the corners. So you have a nice, neat manicure.
You grew up in Hollis Hills, Queens, and your father ran a party rental business, and he died when you were 16, and then your mom took over the business.
Correct. He died a week before my 16th birthday.
How did he die?
Pancreatic cancer. And my mother never worked a day in her life. She was, you know, life was on a silver platter.
So your mom was left with her 5 children and started running this business. Did you help out in the business at all?
Of course. I still do.
What was done? Like, so you rented chairs and tables and balloons and
everything for a party.
It's still in your family?
Yes, it is.
Who runs it now?
Party Time. My mom and my sisters, 2 sisters are full-time and, yep.
Out of Queens?
Yes, Queens Boulevard in Elmhurst.
Your mom was the one who took you, by the way, to your manicures, starting when you were like 6 years old. If you were a good girl in ballet, she would take you to get your nails done.
Absolutely. And that was the only time I sat still. And I sat for 1 hour blowing them dry because there was no such thing as quickie drops or anything like that. You had to sit or else you smudged and you had a mess. So I wanted them to be perfect. So I sat there.
There were not many colors to choose from, at the time. What companies did you use? Do you even remember as a 6-year-old?
I do remember. There were only 2. One was Revlon, and the other was L'Oreal. And that's the joke of the whole story. And there I am, 29 years later, selling my baby to L'Oreal.
Your father also was complicit in this nail polish love affair of yours. He would take you to an apothecary owned by his brother,
owned by a cousin, Uncle Ralph,
to pick out even more colors.
Absolutely. Do you know where the MAC store is on 5th Avenue and 59th Street?
Mm.
There used to be a hotel called the Savoy Plaza Hotel, and that's where Uncle Ralph had his apothecary. Mm-hmm. And we'd go visit Uncle Ralph on Sunday after the Lower East Side, and my dad would let me pick out colors that I would hold in my hand as my conscience for that whole week.
I want to talk about partnerships, the most important of which was with your husband, Max Sortino, who was the CEO for a while.
Yes.
Before you sold the company to L'Oreal. How did you meet Max?
Met Max in California at a trade show. He wanted to buy the only publication that was available at that time, which was called Mainly Manicuring. And instead of purchasing Mainly Manicuring, he met Essie. And he was really originally from Rome, Italy, and living in California.
And at the time, he was in business with his ex-wife selling jewelry for the nails.
Correct. You know, everyone said, oh, Essie, you need a European man. They're the only ones that'll understand a woman in business. Mm. And it was just a great fit.
And at what point did he join you in the business? Was that a no-brainer or did that take some...
Once he moved to New York, he joined me. And Max was always the visionary. I didn't have the name in the glass. Mm. I just felt that every salon loved the polish and they would put their own label on it. And he said, who's putting their label on it?
So it was his idea to put Essie on the bottle.
Absolutely. Another good idea. Not all of them, but most of them.
What were some ungood ideas?
Oh, well, everyone wanted a lipstick to match the nail polish. And, you know, everyone would ask you for it. And it is a great idea. But there are no makeup artists in the salons telling the woman, try this color. Mm. It looks great on you. It just sits there collecting dust.
So how long did you dabble in lipstick?
Probably about 5 years. We didn't give up right away. You know, the truth of the matter is, Essie was born about colors. I mean, that's what I'm known for. Colors on my life.
What does your apartment look like? Is it colorful?
No, it's not, as a matter of fact, because I was always working in color. So the apartment is very much white and dark brown. Lots of woods, different textures. Very simple, because everything else is what I do every single day of my life.
What other mistakes?
Oh, plenty of mistakes. If we didn't make mistakes, we would have never grown. Oh, we came out with a second line. That was a mistake.
What's the second line?
It was called Max. And then we had to change the name to Club Max because one of our competitors went to P&G's and said we were trading under the name of Max Factor, which it was not Max Factor. It was my husband, Max.
P&G, Procter & Gamble,
yeah,
right?
P&G. Yeah,
P&G. Did you ever have other investors aside?
Never.
So it was all run by your sales, all the capital that you
That's
got
it.
From your sales.
And, of course, my mother said to me, you know, you have a year and you'll see what happens. And she said, if it doesn't work, it wouldn't be a Shondo, which is a shame. And that's all I had to hear. I said, you'll wait and see. There'll be no shame here.
Your mom, was she helpful in the business?
Of course. She even came to trade shows. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's amazing. I mean, she's the rock. She really gave us very good values, and we all had to work. And she never takes no for an answer. You know, we've learned that from her. And
were you brought up in a religious household?
Well, we had two sets of dishes. We had a kosher home.
So you were Jewish and kosher.
Jewish, but lots of times that we mixed up the silverware and it was like, oh my God, you have to put it in the dirt outside. Our friends would say, oh, you have flowers and silverware growing in your garden? So, you know, fun things, always fun.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Essie Weingarten, founder of Essie, a nail polish company with more than 300 colors. Essie is available in roughly 25,000 salons in over 100 countries. You mentioned that one of the two nail polish companies that sold nail polish when you were your 6 and 7 year old self, you know, getting a manicure, was L'Oreal. And little did you know that you would sell the company. Sell Essie to L'Oreal, you know, in 2010. You had an initial flirtation with L'Oreal in 2005 when they came to you and was interested in an acquisition. Can you talk about the 2005 conversation?
Well, I got a phone call in the office and the switchboard operator said, there's a call from L'Oreal. Well, everyone in the office, like their ears perked up. They really wanted to buy the company and we were not big enough, number one, and number two, we didn't want to sell the company. There's no reason to sell the company. We said goodbye, and they said they'd never come back.
That was in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to 2010, and L'Oreal approaches you again. Why were things different this time?
Well, we were growing like crazy. I mean, when the economy started to tank in 2008, our business was on fire. At that point, in 2007... business was really good, and we started with an architect. We were going to be adding onto our building. We were expanding the parking lot, and we were going up. And then as the economy started to get funky in 2008, I put the stop sign up, and I said, let's wait and see what's going to happen. Instead, our business just kept on growing double digits, and we were busting at the seams. Of course, he was right, and we should have built. It was 2009, Christmas, when I got a phone call wishing us a Merry Christmas, and I said, they're back, because they said they would never come back. And after that phone call, we didn't hear from them again till I think it was the end of February. And when they called again, they said they want a deal and they want it quick. They were afraid that I was going to back out of the deal, which I could have done very easily. But, you know, if I make a commitment, my word's my bond and I stick by it.
So, but why did you sell?
Because we were busting by the seams. I mean, we really were working like three shifts around the clock. We had no more room.
Mm-hmm. It was, so you needed capital to expand? Or?
No, we had the capital. We just needed location, mm-hmm. number one. I mean, we were very aggressive with inventory, always were, always had containers on the ocean coming in from Italy constantly, mm-hmm. always was aggressive with chemicals. I mean, lots of pails, I was never out of stock, and everyone knew it. You wanted something, you never had to wait for it. And that was, you know, that was part of the magic formula. California, they got it in a week. New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, they had it the next day, and everyone knew it. Yeah. I spoiled my customers rotten, and I loved every minute of it.
Essie is available in over 100 countries, and the first country was Japan.
We were in over 100. We thought 109 when we sold the company. And then they came back to us after the due diligence and said, you didn't tell us the truth. You're in 114 countries.
Do you notice anything culturally different between like what Americans want on their nails versus a woman in Jordan? Do you even sell in Jordan, for example?
Yes, we do, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. The truth of the matter is, when we were in Kuwait, which was quite interesting, there were women praying. And the cultural difference was before they pray, they have their polish removed. And after they're done praying, they get their nails done again. So it's a really great market. And I thought that was something so interesting. And in Dubai, of course, it's completely different. But we were doing a shoot for a magazine, and there was this woman wearing a burqa. And I said, would you like to be in the article? And she said she would. And she took off her burqa, and I never saw anything so beautiful in my whole life. She was a banker. And she said, if my husband sees this, he'll kill me. And I thought I would die. I mean, and this is like only 2008 or 9.
This is in Dubai?
In Dubai. You're saying, wow. The world has moved so fast, and then you find these little clusters where women are still living in the past.
Where do you get your nails done?
I get my nails done at Samuel Shariki on 65th Street.
When you do get manicures at other places, when the people don't know you, do you tell them that you are Essie?
No, of course not. Little stepson would always say, you know who she is? And I would say, Ben, don't do that.
Ben comes with you to get your nails done sometimes?
Oh, Ben would be there, yeah. Very nervous, I will tell you. When they find out, they get extremely nervous. I don't know why, but they do.
Was there ever a time they didn't believe you, that you were indeed Essie?
Well, you know, sometimes I'd go into a salon and it wasn't even to get a manicure, just to be selling product. And I would say, hi, I'm Essie. And they would say, Manny, Manny. And I said, no, I'm Essie. Hello, I just want to, you know, introduce myself. And they get a little bit confused. Mm-hmm. But it was always fun. Yeah. And, you know, the business card always worked.
Right. Now, the market has changed a bit. I mean, it used to be basically exclusively women, and now more and more men are going into salons, and male grooming is, you know, increasing in importance to men. Do you know many men who get their nails polished?
Absolutely. A lot of them will get one color of either one coat of Mademoiselle, which my husband happens to wear, because it just looks like a good finish, almost like a woman's blush. So it's a little bit of something, but it's no one could tell it's a color. And then some men are really getting color. In LA, you'll see men wearing a lot of sandals, flip-flops, and they have pedicures, and they're wearing color. And the first time I saw it was Seal, and he was wearing Dominica Green.
Seal the singer?
Seal the singer. And then he was wearing Aruba Blue, and I went like, Heidi, yes! Mm-hmm. You know, and I've been really fortunate from A to Z. And when I say A to Z, all these celebrities from Angelica Houston to Renee Zellweger, they all wore Essie, and they would share it and tell you these stories. And I never did any celebrity endorsements. They wore it, they spoke about it because they loved it. And I mean, how lucky can a woman be?
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Jessica. Thank you.
My guest has been Essie Weingarten, founder of Essie. Coming up, we'll meet Michael Dubin, co-founder of Dollar Shave Club. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Michael Dubin, co-founder of Dollar Shave Club, a membership club for men's grooming products. For less than $10 a month, customers receive products ranging from razors to hair gel. Michael launched Dollar Shave Club in July 2011, and the company grew to $65 million in revenue in roughly 2 years. Michael graduated from Emory in 2001 and worked in marketing prior to starting Dollar Shave Club. He also did improv comedy at Upright Citizens Brigade in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I love that little fact. What was your goal in signing up for those classes? Did you think, oh, I want a career in comedy one day, or it was just sort of for brain flexibility?
I had always loved the comedy industry, and, you know, I'd wanted to study it. I grew up watching Saturday Night Live, and I wanted to know how those guys did it, and I always had a reasonably good sense of humor, so I thought this sounds like something I'd be interested in training in. I spent a lot of money on those classes, but they paid off because it helped me immeasurably with Dollar Shave Club, so I'm grateful for it.
So you grew up in Philadelphia. Your mom was a teacher, and then she worked in real estate as a real estate broker.
That's right.
And your father is an attorney. What kind of law does he practice?
Tax law. I applied to law school, during the confused years of my early to mid-20s. I was working at NBC and NBC News at the time, and then I had a marketing job that didn't pay a whole lot, and I had a father who was like, yeah, you really should be thinking about law school. So I took the LSAT and applied, and thankfully didn't get in.
So you found yourself at a party in 2011, and you met Mark Levine, and he was the father of a friend's fiance, and you got to talking about shaving. How did the conversation arise? Do you remember it specifically?
Yeah, I do. So Mark was one of these guys who had done a lot of business in Asia, and he was like our. We had a family friend growing up who would always show up with like a truck full of soccer balls or like a truck full of bikes, and you know, he'd honk the horn and we'd come down the driveway and he'd be like, "Hey, you guys need some bikes or soccer balls?" And we'd be like, "Sure, John, we could use some bikes and soccer balls." And Mark was one of these guys similar to our friend John, where he just was kind of always buying stuff and bringing it somewhere else and selling it. And there were a couple things he had in his warehouse. One was some cake slicers that are shaped like an actual wedge of cake. No more fussing around with, you know, a knife and having to make two motions. One fluid motion,
wow.
The cake slice. And then he also told me that he had 250,000 twin razor blades that he had been unable to sell in the drugstore. And he knew that I had experience with the web, and he said, you know, any interest in helping me with any of this stuff? And so, I had two choices. I had the cake slicers or I had the razors. And, you know, almost instantly I had the idea for Dollar Shave Club because guys for so long had been, myself included, frustrated with the process of going to the store to buy this stuff. You have to find the locked razor fortress. You got to find the guy or the girl with the key. They're always doing something else. Mm-hmm. And I just thought there was a much better way to do it.
Where was this party, by the way? Was it in New York?
No, it was in Los Angeles. I'd moved to L.A. in 2009.
Why did you, by the way, move to L.A. from New York City?
Oh, well, I came for a girl and for a job. Huh? And I left the girl and I left the job.
You started working out of your apartment selling the razors, and you created a website. Did the customers come?
Yeah. So from 2011 to 2012, we had a beta website where we were testing different ways of selling the razors. We had bulk and we had subscription, and ultimately, and we had one-off. So I ran that site till early 2012, and we filmed the video, and that's what kind of brought us into the modern era.
You referred to this video. This was a kind of bare bones humor. Thank goodness for Upright Citizens Brigade kind of helping to inspire such comedy. You got help from Lucia Aniello to help you make the video, and she is a writer on Broad City and Time Traveling Bong. How much went into this production of the video?
The making of this video, which has taken on kind of, lore of its own, is a major reason for our success. And I have a few things to thank. One is my time at the Upright Citizens Brigade, where I learned how to really write strong comedy sketch. And our video is essentially a sketch, although it's an advertisement. The other thing I have to thank is that, my experience there led me to a friendship with Lucia. And Lucia just moved to LA to change her career. And, I said to her, listen, I'm starting a company. I need your help filming this video, which I want to put on our homepage. She said, great. We picked a day. I had $4,500. That's all I had. We shot it in one day in our original fulfillment center, which is in Gardena, California, just south of the airport. We went for it, and it turned out okay. And we sat on that for a few months before we launched it.
And so from that video, all of a sudden you wake up and there were 12,000 orders. Were you surprised?
I was totally shocked. I mean, this is one of these moments as a founder at a company that you kind of dream will happen, but never actually think will happen. You plan for months and months. You invest your life savings into something. You think you have a good idea. Everybody tells you you don't. And then you launch this video, and within a matter of 2 hours, your site has crashed because of traffic. That, to me, was terrifying, because in one moment, I thought my wildest dreams had turned into my worst nightmares. And we're very fortunate that we recovered from that moment and that people stuck around and tried again to come to the site, and that, we endured a few days worth of press around it to keep people coming back.
Who did you show the video to prior to launching it? Like, what did your parents think of it, or Mark, or...
Yeah, I showed it to a few friends who really liked it. I remember I was skiing with my family the weekend before we launched the video, and I showed it to them, and they looked at it and they were like, "Yeah, it's not bad."
Tax attorney.
Yeah, no, my dad has a great sense of humor. So does my mom. So does my sister. We're all funny people. But for some reason, this video. I mean, I got maybe a snort or two.
Mm-hmm.
Not encouraging for somebody who just spent the last year and change working on this project and was about to kind of go big.
Yeah, how did you launch it? Do you just like put it up there and hope that people come, or was there something behind getting the viewers?
So we had raised $1 million in seed capital from investors, and we strategically timed the announcement of the funding with the relaunch of the website with the launch of the video. Mm-hmm. And we did that at a time of year when people are waiting for a technology story, which is to say right before South by Southwest. There's a little bit of a quiet period before eyes are on Austin. I think the festival started on the 7th or the 8th, and we launched this on the 6th, and all the media that covered the launch used the video to tell the story. So it went from the tech press to the mainstream press.
Hmm. Before you raised $1 million, you had raised like $100,000 from one investor in Los Angeles. Who was that?
Yeah, the group is called Science. They're an investor based in Santa Monica. Mm-hmm. And when they wrote out the check, they wrote me a $100 check by accident instead of a $100,000 check, which for anybody that knows the folks over at Science, that has special meaning and humor.
And then you went on to raise capital from Andreessen Horowitz and Forerunner and Kleiner Perkins and Venrock. Talk to me about your first couple customers. Do you remember who they were?
Yes. I remember that in the early version, I'll never forget my first customer's name. His name was Imran Charnania from Houston, Texas. I don't know what happened to him. I should look up and see if he's still a member. But good old Imran Charnania was the first customer of Dollar Shave Club. I mean, that validation is gold. There's nothing, there's no money, amount of money that's going to make you feel as good as somebody else with a real brain and a real pocketbook saying yes to your idea. I mean, that feeling is you know, irreplaceable.
I want to talk about the second video that you launched, which was video number two, in which One Wipe Charlie's feature prominently, which is just basically, you know, wipes for men's butts. Did you get that idea because so many people were asking for number two, or what was the chicken and the egg there?
Well, yes, thank you for the very polite way of saying wipes for men's butts. Mm-hmm. Men are using wipes, and they're just not talking about it. And that's not just men with kids. I was using wipes back in college because a friend turned me on to it, and it was a much more pleasant, comfortable way to solve the problem. If Dollar Shave Club is successful at anything, it's speaking with a relatable voice to our members and getting them to change their behavior around their grooming. And, you know, we sell thousands of these things a day.
Yeah.
I have people that come up to me in airports and tell me how it's changed their life. I had a guy stop his conference call in an airport, open his backpack, and show me that he was carrying our travel wipes. And I had a guy in a hot tub come up to me, swim up to me in Hawaii and say, "Sorry to bother you. I just have to tell you, I'm a huge fan of these One Wipe Charlies. My girlfriend actually made me buy them because she says I wasn't doing a good enough job."
Wow. Okay.
And so, you know, I feel like, you know, I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I know what doctors kind of go through when a doctor tells somebody that they're a doctor. They get all kinds of like unsolicited information. That's kind of what happens to me now.
So men's grooming, it seems like there's that men are taking more ownership over their aesthetic life. Why do you think that is?
Well, without trying to sound too pitchy, mm-hmm. I will tell you that, you know, it's our belief that men are sort of evolving emotionally and physically as it relates to this category. You know, the United States is behind Asia and Europe in sort of the sophisticated nature of men's grooming. There have been guys that, you know, are kind of your standard, you know, Pert Plus Irish Spring guys, not just to pick on two kind of legacy brands. You know, they just kind of grab whatever's there. To them, soap is soap. And then there's a lot of guys who are very proud to say, yeah, you know what, I'm thinking very critically about the ingredients that go into my daily face moisturizer with SPF. So you got to get guys all over the map.
My son, who's 5, the other day started using gel in his hair. So we bought him like Dippity Doo. And it was striking to me that he doesn't have any cultural influence, but that was just an innate interest in making sure his hair looked good.
Yeah.
Do you use gel in your hair?
I don't use gel. I use our cream, our hair cream.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Michael Dubin, co-founder of Dollar Shave Club, an e-commerce mail order company for men's grooming products. The company started off by selling razors for a few dollars per month in 2011 and now offers products ranging from hair cream to body cleanser. I noticed that a lot of companies that have launched lately also have a similar tongue-in-cheek humor. I'm not sure that's the best description, but I think of like Sir Kensington's ketchup, right? Or even Oscar Health or your company. They all have like this pared-down humor to them that really resembles each other. Do you get that sense that like in our culture there's some type of, there's an appreciation for a certain type of humor that, you know, 50 years ago if you were launching, it wouldn't have resonated as much?
Yeah, I think we as a culture are much more comfortable with humor and pushing the boundaries of humor. We also recognize the importance of speaking, you know, like a peer to customers, you know, and not kind of down to customers. And so companies have gotten much more familiar in their language and their approach. You know, razors at this point are essentially a commodity. I think about what Dollar Shave Club is doing very much like what Starbucks did for coffee. So remember what there was before coffee. Mm-hmm. Before coffee, there was darkness, just a black hole in the universe. But before Starbucks, you know, what were you drinking? Folgers, Maxwell House. It was, you know, relatively unexciting and functional. And then, you know, Howard Schultz came along and said, wait a second, this is a moment in your life that is to be celebrated. It's a ritual, and it's something that's that deserves a culture. It's all its own. You know, Dollar Shave Club is doing the same thing with the razor commodity and with its men's grooming products. We're saying that this is a really important part of your life that needs to be celebrated and deserves a culture all its own. So when people ask us, are you a razor company? Are you a men's grooming company? I say, actually, no, we're an experience company. And it starts the moment you see an advertisement, and it continues every month that you get a shipment from us.
What has been harder for you than you thought in all of this?
You know, scaling a company to 200 employees is a very big challenge. It's very easy for you when you're a small company and there's six people in a room or 25 people in a room. But when you scale to 175, 200 people, and there are many layers to the organization, your bad habits, you know, you don't get away with your bad habits as well. And you really have to put in process. And this is not a journey that's unique to Dollar Shave Club. Anybody that's gone from zero to 200 or beyond has been through this. And that was harder than I expected.
What do your parents make of all this, the teacher and the tax attorney?
At first, they didn't really believe what was happening, because they saw the video. They didn't think it was very funny, and they were kind of taken aback and blindsided by the sudden spotlight on their son. Slowly, they kind of got used to the fact that we were doing something disruptive and something that was worth kind of looking at. And you know, now they're thrilled. I mean, they're super proud.
How would your parents describe you?
Well, so when I was a kid, they gave me this nickname called the Blitherer. Because I would sort of blither on, and I think they meant blither lovingly. I don't even know if blither is a real word, is it? You know, people might describe me as a blitherer now, too.
Well, that's ironic, because in the videos that I've seen, there's real economy to your writing.
I think that's what good writing is all about. You know, someone once said, maybe it was Mark Twain, I wrote you a long letter because I didn't have time to write a short one.
Can you tell me just briefly about your own grooming regimen?
Why, yes. My own grooming regimen begins in the morning when I get into the shower, and I'll wash my hair, and then I'll wash my body. Then I'll get out of the shower, and if it's one particular day, I'll shave. After I'm done shaving, I'll put on a daily face moisturizer with SPF. And when I'm done, maybe I'll sit down on the toilet and use some One Wipe Charlies. And, you know, sometimes I'll snip my eyebrows if I have to. Mm-hmm. I once saw this barber do something really cool, like cut my ear hair with a string, like a knitting string. Have you seen this?
Oh, yes. Women do it for their brows.
Oh, my God. It's an amazing trick.
Yes.
How do I mean, there must be a web video I can watch on how to do that.
What might I not know about you?
I make really good homemade popcorn.
Why is it?
Why is it so good?
Yeah, what makes it?
Well, I don't make microwave
popcorn.
It's
a commodity.
It is a commodity because I build an experience around it. It's my way of saying don't make microwave popcorn.
What else?
Let's see. When I first moved to California, I had an apartment that was near the beach, and I would see all these sailboats go by, and I'd never learned how to sail a boat. So I took a couple classes, and now I'm a licensed sailor.
Has there been, you know, one or two people who have been kind of unlikely allies for you that have really helped to transform, like, accelerate the trajectory of things?
What's really rewarding and fun is when you meet reputable, sort of even famous people that are members of Dollar Shave Club. And you're like, whoa, that's really interesting. Like, you know, this person's a member. Mm-hmm. And they're like going out of their way to tell me how much they love the club. And that's like really cool. I had this idea in my apartment.
For example.
I don't know.
Breaching privacy.
Yeah, but, I don't know if I'm allowed to do that. I'll tell you what's the reverse. It was a super bummery, is like, you know, with 3.1 million members, like members of ours have definitely died.
Mm.
And that's like something that I just actually was thinking about the other day.
Yep.
Like,
how do you end the accounts? Well, they stop paying and then you find out that they've died.
Usually someone will reach out and say, you know, I mean, this is a pretty morose topic, but, you know, it is something to think about. Like somebody that saw a commercial, signed up, enjoyed the club for a time, has now moved on to the great club in the sky, or the great kind of underground club. There's different clubs that you go to after. look, death is, for all the listeners out there, it awaits us all.
Well, you could turn it into an experience.
That's right.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Michael Dubin, co-founder of Dollar Shave Club.
If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.